It's a great honor to be joined today by Dr. Franz de Waal. He is a primatologist and the C.H. Candler Professor of Psychology at Emory University and director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. He's been elected to the National Academy of Sciences, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the Royal Dutch Academy of Sciences. He's the best-selling author of many books, including Chimpanzee Politics, Good Natured, Our Inner Ape, The Age of Empathy, Mama's Last Hug, and most recently, Different, Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist, which we're going to be talking about today. Dr. de Waal, welcome to the Nature and Nurture podcast.
I'm glad to be there.
I'm very excited to be speaking with you today. So maybe we could start off very broadly. What motivated you to write a book on gender, which, as you mentioned in the introduction, can be a sensitive topic?
Yeah, it is surely a sensitive topic. So yeah, I noticed that each time I give lectures, because I sometimes lecture for large groups of people, each time I mention sex differences in the primates, and I say, for example, males are more violent or females are more empathic, then people want to know more about it. And people are curious. I think there's a great curiosity about the biology of gender in society, because very often people get a one-sided perspective. So they read blogs or articles who try to present everything as socialization and culture, and it's a construct. And I think people are very skeptical about that, because they think there's more to it than just a construct. And so they then want to hear from a primatologist, but he thinks, a biologist like myself, And they think I'm going to give a simple answer, which is delusional, because I'm giving a complex answer. Because, you know, people think that in the primates we see the biology and in humans we see the culture. But actually in the primates we also see some culture, and in humans we also see plenty of biology. And so the answer is not so simple. It's always an interaction. Well, in Nature and Nurture, your program is about the interaction. And so it's always an interaction between the two. But for sure, biology needs to be part of the picture. It needs to be discussed in the gender discussion.
Right. If the culture isn't emerging from some sort of something biological, where does it come from?
Yeah. I've sometimes speculated, what would happen if we were a cloning species? Cloning means that we have no genitals. There's no need for genitals because we are not sexually reproducing. We don't need to mate. We just chop off an arm and the arm grows into a new human being there. That's cloning. Mm-hmm. So then we would all be identical people. We would all look alike. I don't think anyone would have come up with the concept of gender at that point. The gender concept comes from the fact that we have two sexes. Mm-hmm. And even though gender is a much more flexible concept, and we have more than two sexes, so the two sexes binary is a sort of simplification of things. But even then, the gender concept is related to the fact that we have sexes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In cloning species, are they literally identical, or do you just see individual variability on axes other than sex?
They have not much reason for individual variability. Cloning species, they're actually very rare, because sexual reproduction is so successful in reshuffling the genes all the time that plants and animals for a billion years, they have been sexually reproducing. So it's a very successful concept, sexual reproduction. And I think that we have genders is related to that.
Is it always binary? Are there any species that have some sort of more complex sexual reproduction that involves more than two?
Yeah, it can get really complex. So you have certain fish who start their life as female and then they end their life as male, you know. So don't ask me all these variations that exist, because I'm mostly into the primates where it is like in humans. But there's an enormous amount of complexity going on. Also, in terms of the chromosomes, everyone thinks it's XX and XY, but there's a lot more variability in humans, but also in other species. Mm-hmm. And so, the sexes, the biological sexes is a very complex picture. And then gender, since it is the cultural expression of how you behave as a man or as a woman and so on, gender is even more complex than that, I would think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So there there's some overlap, and then there's also the some portion to which sex and gender are distinct, with certain things being gendered. Like we can talk about color preferences, for example. Yeah. blue for boys or pink for girls, although that was reversed in the past in the US. And then yeah. I would have said toy preferences, but you outline in the book that the toy preferences we see, so something like males playing with trucks and females with dolls, we even see those toy preferences in primates.
Yeah. Yeah, so people have done experiments giving human toys to monkeys, and then the young females end up with the dolls and the young males end up with the trucks, even though I think it's an odd experiment because trucks don't mean anything for monkeys in the wild. So The dolls I can still see. The dolls relate to infants and animals, and they can be held close. And actually, there's a study of wild chimpanzees that shows that young females, they pick up wooden logs and rocks and handle them like dolls. They put them on their back and their belly, and they carry them around, and they even build nests for them. So the doll part I can follow. The truck part I can't follow in these experiments. Mm-hmm. But the doll part I can, because young females are incredibly interested in babies, much more so than young males. And so as soon as a female monkey comes into her group with a new baby, a newborn, she's going to be surrounded by young females who want to hold the baby or touch the baby. Mm-hmm. And when they're older, when the mother starts to trust them, they may become the babysitter. And actually, females let these young adolescent females, they let them babysit, which males they rarely do, but with young females they do. Yeah.
When young females exhibit this mothering behavior, are they typically imitating their mothers, or could this emerge spontaneously if you had young females that were raised alone?
Oh, they imitate adults, and it's actually essential for them to develop maternal skills, because we often speak of the maternal instinct, which is a misnomer, because there is an instinctual, let's say, an inborn attraction to infants that we can see. But the skills of mothering are very complex. So let's say you're a gorilla female and you have a baby in your lap. The baby is very small. How does that baby get to your nipple? That's not logical. The baby is not going to get there by itself. The baby needs to be brought to the nipple. So the female needs to know that that has to happen. And if she has never seen a mother do anything, and if she has no experience whatsoever, she may not do that at all. And that's why zoos are always worried if they have a pregnant ape and the ape has no experience and the group has no experience. They're very worried. And they bring in human mothers then, usually, who then nurse their babies in front of the gorillas for a couple of days. And the gorillas watch them. And sometimes that has a positive effect. So there's always imitation involved. And that's why actually the mothering skills are culturally transmitted. And we speak a lot of culture about culture in animals nowadays. And I would say the same applies probably to sex typical behavior. So how you act as a male and how you act as a female. And that means that the gender concept is also applicable to other primates, because they have also cultural transmission of behavior. Maybe less so than humans, but still it happens.
Yeah. What does parenting look like in males for primates?
Well, the male, I usually compare with chimpanzees and bonobos, which are our closest relatives, and the males do extremely little. So the males may protect a young one. That may happen. But carrying and feeding and protecting and waiting for them like the mothers do, that doesn't happen. But they have the capacity. That's so interesting about it. We have seen in the wild and in captivity too, that if a mother dies and all of a sudden there's a young chimp or a young bonobo, let's say 3 or 4 years old, which is by the time that they going to be able to survive on solid foods, mm-hmm. because they have a very long nursing period. So let's say it's a 3 or 4 year old baby chimp, then a male, even the alpha male, may adopt. And that has been observed in the wild. And these adoptions are not just for a few days, they may be for a few years. So they really adopt a youngster because females usually don't adopt. The females have their own kids and they don't want to interfere with the raising of their own children. So it's the males who do that. And that shows that they have caring tendencies. They have caring capacities, which I think in the human discussion at this moment is extremely important to know, that our close relatives, even though the males usually do very little, they are certainly capable of it. They have the capacity. Mm-hmm. And that is, of course, for the human male important, because I sometimes hear in the conservative media that they make fun of paternity leaves. You know, I'm European. I'm very used to maternity leaves and paternity leaves, which in some countries are half a year or more. I don't know why the U.S. is one of the only countries that I know that doesn't have them. And so the conservative media make fun of paternity leave as if that's some sort of nonsense. But, you know, male involved in care for offspring is an important part of the gender discussion, I would say. And human males even have more of a capacity in that regard than chimps and bonobos, because we are a species that evolved nuclear families. So obviously, males are even more primed to do that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. What pushed us in that direction to move away from the males being uninvolved or less involved in parenting towards being the biparental species we are today?
Yeah, I think when we evolved the nuclear family, men got involved in offspring care, but maybe not the day-to-day care of carrying and feeding and all of that, but more providing for the family. So it's a bit more distant than what the women were doing. Mm-hmm. But I think men have clearly that capacity. And I don't know why we moved away from that. I'm not even sure that that's recent. It is probably very fairly recent, but you know, I'm not an anthropologist. I don't know how in let's say hunter-gatherer societies, how much the men are doing in terms of carrying kids and things like that. I don't know that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the main takeaways from the book for me was looking at this triangle of closely related apes, humans, chimpanzees, and bonobos. And before reading this, I didn't know much about bonobos at all. And you seem to comment that that's not too surprising that people think of chimps more, but then having chimps as more patriarchal, larger, stronger, more violent, more dominant, more competitive, and then on the other end you have bonobos who are female dominated and more peaceful, more loving, and then humans somewhere in the middle, and then equally related to both of them, sharing both of those traits on either end.
Yeah, the bonobos have been neglected. And that's partly because they're too peaceful, they're too female dominated, they're too sexy. They have a lot of sex going on. Mm-hmm. And you know, we live, especially here in the US, we live in a Puritan culture. Sex is not the best topic to discuss. I've often had fights with people who make nature documentaries like BBC and NHK and so on. Why aren't there more documentaries about bonobos? Why are there so many about chimps? And then they usually say, oh, because the chimps have lots of action. And what they mean is violence. They have fights and they like that. But, you know, bonobos have lots of action, but it's sexual action. Mm-hmm. And they don't like to show that. They are a bit nervous about that. And so it's partly the bonobos don't do the things that people feel our close relatives need to do, which is killing each other. Mm-hmm. So, and bonobos are female dominated, so that doesn't help either, because then you have to explain how that comes about. And then the peacefulness is also a problem, because there are many theories about human evolution that stress very much warfare, that stress how we exterminated everybody, including the Neanderthals, even though from DNA studies, we now know that we did also other things with Neanderthals than exterminating them. We interbred with them. But anyway, the bonobo doesn't fit that narrative of humans are an aggressive species and that's how we conquered the world. They don't fit it. And people are nervous about that and they don't want to talk about that.
Yeah, it shows how culturally ingrained that sort of more violent, competitive narrative of nature is. Because when I think about chimpanzee violence, I don't think it's something to emulate, but it kind of makes sense to me. And then it's more surprising when I think that bonobos evolved to be so peaceful and so sexual how did that happen?
Yeah. And I wonder why you think that the chimp violence makes so much sense. Because, you know, chimps, most of the time, they're not violent. Most of the time, they get along. They have close relationships. The males have friendships. They support each other. They groom each other. Most of the time, they're not so violent. But but we focus, it's like the daily news. We focus on the bad things. And if they happen, we say, see, that's how chimpanzees are. But they are not always like that. And there's also cultural differences in chimps. The East African chimps, of which we know the most, you know, like Jane Goodall studied the East African chimps, they are more violent than the West African chimps, who do much less of that. So yeah, we focus often on violence. That is a sort of tradition. But, you know, the bonobos don't kill each other. We don't have any observations of one bonobo killing another bonobo. We do have that kind of observations for chimps. So it is a substantial difference between bonobos and chimps. But, you know, there's many human societies, too, that are quite peaceful. Mm-hmm. So it's not something we should be too surprised about, because we've had very peaceful societies and we have sometimes very aggressive societies.
Mm-hmm. So if we think back to our last common ancestor between chimpanzees and bonobos and humans, I know there's not really any evidence for it, but do you think it's more likely that it was something closer to a chimpanzee and then bonobos were a branch off and humans as well that became more peaceful? Or was it the other way around? Chimpanzees emerged as kind of this more intersexually competitive species?
We don't know the last common ancestor because things don't fossilize in the forest. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know how that species looked, what it looked like. It may also have looked like gorillas, may have looked like gibbons. People have speculated all sorts of things. Chimps and bonobos, they split much later than that last ancestor. So they, the ancestral species may have been chimp-like or bonobo-like. We don't know. Sometimes I think that that the chimpanzee, being sometimes so violent, maybe actually the outlier of the whole bunch. But of course, many people who have invested in the chimpanzee, they think the bonobo is the outlier. So yeah, we have these debates. It's we cannot solve it with DNA, because the DNA studies say that chimps and bonobos are exactly equally close or equally distant from us. And that's why I feel that in a discussion about gender, for example, we need to take both of them. There's no reason to prefer one over the other. Even though some people would do that. Some people like the bonobo better because it's a female-dominated species. And some people like the chimp better because they identify more with a male-dominated species. But I think we should consider both.
Mm-hmm. Right. It makes a lot of sense to me to look at both of them as like two extremes and seeing humans fall somewhere in the middle in terms of being male or female-dominated and in terms of being violent or peaceful. It seems like in all these different domains, we're more of a middle ground.
Yeah. We have our own specialties, of course. We have the nuclear family, which is a human specialty. So we share the male bonding with chimps. Chimps are male bonded species. The males hang out together, even though there's a lot of rivalry. They're also friends at the same time. And I know some people find that hard to understand how that's possible, but I would say the human male is not very different. The human male also lots of rivalries and friendships at the same time. So that's something we share with the chimp. The female bonding of the bonobos have a sisterhood that collectively dominates the males. Individual female bonobos cannot dominate the males. They're smaller, but collectively they do. And that is something that I think we also share. We share that with the bonobos. We have a lot of female bonding in human society. And then the nuclear family is our own thing, is something we evolved.
Yeah. So when you mentioned the nuclear family, does that have to do with pair bonding?
It has to do with drawing males into the area of offspring raising. So the nuclear family in humans can be very variable. It can be one male and one female and children, which is very often what it is in many places. But it can also be one male with several females or one female with several males. There's all sorts of variations possible. But men are involved in caring for the family. That's the important part of it, I think. And people sometimes ask, are we naturally monogamous? Well, I think that's a sort of silly question. It's like we act monogamous, but we also act non-monogamous in many ways. And, you know, in biology, we usually talk about social monogamy and genetic monogamy. Mm-hmm. Genetic monogamy would be when all the children of a pair, male and female, are fertilized by the sired by the male. That would be genetic monogamy, but that's very rare in the animal kingdom. Also in birds, very rare. So, mm-hmm. so it's usually social monogamy.
Yeah. Right. So you could look at sexual dimorphism as kind of a rough marker for how monogamous or not a species is. Is that right?
Yeah, people do that. Yeah. Yeah, you could. Yeah.
So humans are sexually dimorphic. Males are on average bigger than females. Less so than chimps, though. So is that just to say that throughout history we've been more monogamous than chimps, but not fully? Or is it more like it's a remnant of when we were less monogamous and that over time the dimorphism has gone down?
Yeah, you know, the sexual dimorphism we think is driven by male-male competition. Mm-hmm. So the more competition there is between, because people often think that men are bigger than women, larger than women, in order to dominate women. That's really not how it happened. It has to do with male-male competition. And the more male-male competition you have, the bigger the males need to get, like in the gorilla is twice, the male is twice the size of the female. That is not because he needs to dominate his females. That is because he has male competitors that he needs to fight, and it's very intense between them. So sexual dimorphism is driven by male-male competition, and it just means that humans have male-male competition, but not as intense as some other species. Mm-hmm. And our sexual dimorphism is not very impressive to the primatologist because we have species where it's much bigger. And chimps and bonobos also, they are closer to humans in that regard. They have a size difference, but it's not so extreme.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned in the book that physical size and strength doesn't necessarily equate to dominance, that sometimes the alpha male in a group might be the smallest male.
Yeah. Yeah, I think people need to move away from this idea that physical dominance is all we have. So, In chimpanzees, the smallest male may be the dominant male because he has the best connections or he has female support, whatever. It's a political system, basically. It's not based on individual capacities necessarily. It's also based on social skills. And so, and also in chimpanzees where the males dominate usually the females, the females can have an enormous amount of power. So my last book, Mama's Last Hug, was about Mama, the alpha female of chimpanzees, the colony that I worked with. And she was alpha female for 40 years. She saw many males come and go as alphas. And she had a big impact. A male could not dream of becoming the alpha male if he didn't have her support. So who's then the most powerful? If mama, the chimpanzee, could decide which male was the alpha male, who's then the most powerful? So I always make that distinction between power and physical dominance. And sometimes they overlap, sometimes they diverge from each other. And people are sometimes surprised by that. But in human society, we are very, you don't walk into a business in New York and ask for the boss and assume that the biggest fellow that you see standing around must be the boss. That's not how we operate, we humans. And the same is true for a primate society. It's very hard at a glance to see who's the boss. You need to know more about them. And sometimes it's an older individual, and it can be an older female like mama. It's an older individual who takes a lot of the decisions in that society. Mm-hmm.
Where did the hierarchies emerge from? Is it just a natural phenomenon, or are there social benefits to being in this hierarchical structure as opposed to more egalitarian?
Yeah, hierarchies are everywhere. So you put some fish together, you get a hierarchy. Mm-hmm. You put some chickens together. The pecking order comes from chickens. You put some dog puppies together. You put human children together at the first day of daycare, and they're going to form a hierarchy. They beat each other up, and they make a hierarchy. It's a very old tendency, and it reduces competition. It's interesting. It's, of course, established by competition and fighting. But once it is established, a couple of days later, the aggression disappears, because now everyone knows their place, and there's no need, not much need to, for fighting. So hierarchies emerge, and they have a constructive purpose. And I know that many people think that egalitarianism is probably preferable. But we don't have egalitarian human societies. We don't have, of course, sometimes we speak of egalitarian societies, but for example, in the gender relations, they're almost never egalitarian. It's always men dominating women. Mm-hmm. So they basically don't exist, and they can't exist. If you need to take decisions, let's say I did research in operation rooms with surgeons and in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Imagine that a place like that would be egalitarian, because normally it's the surgeon, of course, who decides everything in the operation room. Right. Let's say it was egalitarian. I wouldn't want to be in that room as a patient. I wouldn't want to be with a team that has to discuss for 2 hours before they're going to take out a piece of me. I want a guy who, or a woman who is effective and decisive and says, this has to go. And I don't want an egalitarian system. And I think in the military, we also don't want an egalitarian system. So egalitarian systems are fine up to a certain point. But when decisions mm-hmm. need to be made or action needs to be undertaken, I'm not sure we want that.
Right, you know? Right. So you can say that it's a natural consequence of individual variability in competence on different domains.
Could be competence, it could also be fighting power, mm-hmm. could also be coalitions, because, you know, if you put, let's say, chimpanzee males together, I work with a lot with captive animals. If you put chimpanzee males together, they establish very quickly a hierarchy, usually based on who is bigger and who is stronger. But then a couple of weeks later, they start to do their politicking. They start to form coalitions. Like, I am maybe the alpha male, but you have a friend who really likes you, and you like your friend, and you hang out together a lot, and you think we can oust him, and that's what you're going to do. You together, you're going to put me out of that position. And that's what chimpanzee males do all the time. All this politicking of alliances, it's very like Washington is like that also, you know, mm-hmm. like very much coalition formation. And so that's how you end up sometimes with the smallest male being the alpha male, because that's a possibility.
How stable are these chimp hierarchies over time?
The male hierarchy changes constantly because they're constantly jockeying for position. So an alpha male may be alpha male for sometimes in the wild, the longest was, I think, 12 years. Mm-hmm. But more typical is 4 years, 3 years, things like that. The female hierarchy is extremely stable. So Mama, the chimpanzee, was alpha female for 40 years. She could barely walk, and she was blind, almost blind, by the end. And she was still the alpha female. That would never happen among the males. But in females, there's an enormous respect for age. So age is a plus for a female. It's not a plus for a male, but it's a plus for a female. So age is an important factor, and that stabilizes the whole system, basically.
So there seems to be some benefit to that stability, because you could imagine, let's say there's an alpha, and then there's going to be two chimps ranking below. They could form a coalition and potentially overthrow that alpha. But I imagine being number two or number three isn't that bad, and maybe you just prefer the stability to restarting a new conflict.
Yeah, you're naive, I think, there, because they all want to be alpha male.
Uh-huh.
So being number two is not the same as being number one.
Okay.
So the alpha male actually has quite a stressful position. They mm-hmm. they did one time a study of baboons, baboon male hierarchy, and they collected fecal samples to measure cortisol, which is a stress hormone. And what they found is that the low-ranking males, they had elevated stress levels, as you would expect. Being lower ranking is not a good thing.
Right.
But the high stress level was in the alpha male. The mm-hmm. alpha male needs to look the whole day over his shoulder. He cannot trust anybody. because they're all out to get his position. And so being alpha male is actually quite stressful. It's not necessarily a pleasant position to be in, but all the males would want to be alpha male. Uh-huh. So yeah, you can say, why not be number two or three? That's fine. There are males, and I describe in my book how some males don't follow them, the macho line that they want to be alpha male. So there's always some males, maybe one in 10 or one in 20, who are big and strong, but they don't play the macho game, and they stay out of confrontations. They don't form coalitions with other males. So they don't really fit the typical male mold. You also have females. I think that's one of the most interesting parts that I discovered thinking about gender in the primates, is that you also have females who don't follow the mold. So I describe a female named Donna, who was born as a female, but the older she got, the more she acted like a male. And she got the big hair and the big shoulders and the big head of the males. She started to look like a male, and she acted like a male, and she associated with males. And so I cannot ask her identity, but she seemed to identify as a male. Mm-hmm. And so we have that kind of variability in the primates. We have individuals who don't fit the mold. And I think that's incredibly interesting. We also have, of course, individuals who are more homosexual than heterosexual. So in that regard, we also have variability. And so the whole discussion about human gender, which now at the moment revolves very much around trans people, and what kind of freedoms we have in being one gender or the other, that whole discussion could be applied to the other primates because they have gender diversity too. Mm-hmm. And what I find so fascinating is that they have no trouble with it. So I've never noticed that, for example, Donna had trouble with being what she is. No one makes a fuss about it. It's just they accept it as some sort of personality characteristic, basically. That's how she is. And as long as she doesn't interfere with the lives of others, which she doesn't, as long as she doesn't do that, everything is fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's Donna is a natural example of someone who might be considered non-binary, or at least exists sort of on the in-between of this gender spectrum.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned before that the United States in particular is very sexually conservative, and that's influenced the history of biology. Do you think that's playing a role in our perspectives on gender as well?
Yeah, I think I don't know why people are so nervous about bodies and sex. And you know, my first shock in the US when I came in the 1980s. Well, the very first was that I needed to fill out a piece of paper before I could enter the country saying that I was not a communist and I was not a homosexual. I never heard, you know, I came from the Netherlands where we had already all these discussions about homosexuality were behind us and we were the first to have gay marriage in the world. And so for me, homosexuality was really not an issue. I couldn't understand why a whole nation would worry about me being homosexual, but I had to fill that out. But the first shock I got was when I lived in the 1980s in Wisconsin, and I saw in the local newspaper that a woman had been arrested in the supermarket because she was breastfeeding her baby. And that blew me away. How is it possible that breastfeeding could lead to an arrest? That sounded so ridiculous. But since that time, I've learned that that's the US is very nervous about bodies and very nervous about nipples and very nervous about everything. You know, Nipplegate happened here. I think it was a nipple was visible for half a second on TV and the nation collapsed. So yeah, it's a very nervous nation in terms of sex. I always notice that when I talk about bonobos for audiences, if I talk about bonobos for my classes at Emory or audiences in the US, everyone goes quiet if I show sexual scenes. The whole room goes quiet. If I do that in France or in the Netherlands, everyone gets happy and agitated. It's like they think it's wonderful to see that. So yeah, that's a very different reaction. And that steers the discussion about gender. I think people are nervous about these issues. They don't know how to talk about them. Mm-hmm. So for example, in the abortion debate, it's a very sensitive topic, of course, and I'm not going to say anything about when life begins or nothing, but I do know how you can fight abortion. The Netherlands has the lowest abortion rate in the world, lowest teenage pregnancy rate. And how do they do it? They have very early sex education, and sex it starts at 4 years of age. It's not focused on STDs or something like that. It's focused on how you decide when to have sex and how to have sex and so on. You need very early sex education, and you need complete availability of birth control for everyone for free. And if you do that, that's the most effective way to fight abortion. But now the US has decided to fight it in a very different way, which I don't agree with.
Yeah. Are you familiar with parasite stress theory?
I know some of that, but I know some of that. So you wonder if bonobos have more parasites or what?
A while ago, I spoke with Randy Thornhill about this, and he made a case connecting human conservative values to disease prevalence over time. So he points for example, to the ancient Romans, who were among the first to have sanitation and aqueducts and all of these great advances, and they were also very sexually permissive. And then go to the Middle Ages, where a lot of that technology was lost, and people are very conservative again. Now that wouldn't exactly connect to the US, but I'm wondering if there are those sorts of variability between troops in chimps or bonobos. So like, let's say some live in higher parasite areas or and seem to be more sexually conservative or not.
I don't know. I don't think bonobos will ever be sexually conservative. Mm-hmm. Because for them, sex, because people sometimes call them liberated, but they never were, conservative. So there was not a point at which bonobos got liberated. Bonobos have sex in all combinations of individuals, a lot of female-female sex. And the female-female sex is political, because the females have a sisterhood that collectively dominates the males, which they need to maintain. And so sexual contact is a political instrument for them. They also, the females have a very big clitoris. The biggest clitoris is in the animal kingdom. We find in dolphins and in bonobos. And both species have a lot of extra reproductive sex in the sense of sexual interaction that have nothing to do with reproduction. So the bonobo female has a big clitoris. She probably enjoys sex quite a bit. There's some evidence for that. And I've never heard about the parasite load of bonobos being higher or lower or whatever than another species. People could do research on that, but I've never heard that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So chimpanzees are more violent towards out-group members than in-group members. With bonobos, do you see something similar where their sex is sort of reserved for the in-group, or could you easily assimilate an out-group bonobo and they would become sexualized with that?
Oh, they're so interesting in that regard, is that the chimpanzees are xenophobic. They, mm-hmm. they will kill outside of their group, especially males will kill males outside of their group. The bonobos are sometimes called xenophilic in the sense that they like strangers. And experiments have been done at the sanctuary at Lola. That's the only sanctuary for bonobos in the world. Experiments have been done showing that bonobos are willing to do favors for strangers. So if you create a situation where they can get food to a stranger, they will do that. So bonobos, they actually like strangers, and bonobo groups in the wild, they sometimes meet and then they mingle. And the females, it's driven by the females. The females will groom each other. They will have sex with each other. They even may share food with each other. Which all of which doesn't happen in the chimp. The chimp is very xenophobic. So we humans, we have that territoriality. We have that a bit in common with the chimp, more with chimps, I would say, than with bonobos. Because bonobos, they are they like strangers.
Mm-hmm. And they like and do favors for females more often than males, right? Even among the primatologists who are at the study site.
Yeah, the problem is that the female bonobos, they are not very fond of males. And mm-hmm. so male investigators. So I have worked all my life with bonobos and chimps. The bonobo females, they sometimes like me, but in a sexual way. They will wave at me and show their genitals to me. And so they flirt with me. But they don't consider me part of their community. I'm not part of that. So mm-hmm. so I had a female student, Amy Parrish, who also did a lot of studies on the bonobos. And she was very accepted by them, by the females. And she even sometimes got food thrown at her. So across the moat, the bonobos in captivity, they would throw food at her as if she needed to be fed, which they never did with me. And I've heard from some male scientists that working with bonobos in captivity, that they got some resistance that I don't think the female scientists get. So the bonobos make a distinction, like all animals, between males and females, also in humans. All animals do that. And being a male is not necessarily a plus in the bonobo society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this would be a great place to talk about some of the history of feminism and how it influenced primatology, which you talk about in the book. Once female primatologists started emerging into the field, a lot of more male-dominated theories started being swept away.
Yeah, so then I think it happened first with the baboons. Mm-hmm. The baboons were the first primates in the field who were studied intensively, but partly because it's very easy. The baboons live in an open area, so you don't have to look into the forest and the trees. So they're more easily visible and more approachable, and so the early studies were on baboons. And many male scientists. And the initial view, I believe, was that the baboon troop was organized by the males. The males protected the troop, and the males had a sort of military organization of a hierarchy. And the females lived in that, of course, and were protected by the males. That's how the view was at the time, until women scientists came, who said, no, these females, the females have bonds, they have kinship bonds, they groom each other the whole day, they support each other. The males actually come and go, because in baboons, the adolescent males, they leave the troop, and then other males come in. So the males are not actually, the core of the troop is a bunch of females and their kin and their offspring. And so the women started to change the story on the baboons. And I think this happened throughout primatology, is that when women became more common, and now they are very common because I think there's more female primatologists than male at the moment, they brought in new topics like offspring care, kinship relationships, female choice in mate choice, you know. Is it just the males who decide who mates with whom, or have the females also a say in that? And we now know that females have a big say in that. And so they started to change the story on that. Mm-hmm. And you know, sometimes this has been taken by people like Donna Haraway and people who have written about primatology as showing how primatology is culturally biased, is like we project into primatology our cultural preferences. But that's not really how it works, because all these women scientists, they need to follow the same rules of science as the male scientists. So yes, we may have different perspective and different approaches and different interests. That is possible. That may be gender-based to some degree. Mm-hmm. But how you collect your data and how you analyze your data and present them in scientific articles, that is the same for everybody. And right. So science has rules of evidence, and everybody needs to follow them, whether you're a man or a woman, doesn't matter.
Right, so it might influence what types of questions you're asking, but then as soon as you get the answers to those questions, the answers are gonna be judged on an objective yeah. basis.
Yeah, it changes your perspective. So for example, me being from a country like the Netherlands, which which is too small to wage war. You know, we're not like Germany or the US or China, let's say, a small country. And so it's a small country built on consensus and tolerance to some degree. And I've always been interested in conflict resolution, for example. So I've always been interested in the primates. How do they resolve their conflicts? And I think that's a cultural bias that I have brought to my field because I'm from a different place. And so I'm more interested in conflict resolution and cooperation and empathy and that kind of issues. And I think that's a cultural bias. And I think all the scientists bring cultural biases to the things that they study. The Japanese scientists, for example, we have a lot of primatologists who are Japanese. They have always been interested in the community, in the society, what holds it together. That has been their interest. And I think that's also a cultural influence that they have that interest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really admire in the book how you take a very unbiased perspective, not only on gender, but just in this whole sort of is-ought debate about describing primate behavior. Like you can look at both, you know, good and bad, violent and peaceful, but not really call it good or bad, just say this is what happens.
Yeah. I'm not very much in favor to say that, you know, you have what is called a naturalistic fallacy, which is that you take the behavior and you say, this is the natural behavior, and then take that as an example of how we ought to behave. That's a very dangerous position to take. And so I'd rather describe what I know about chimps and bonobos, and what we know nowadays about humans, and then compare. And there are comparisons. It's important to point that out. In gender, there are things that we claim about gender that are simply not true. So for example, people often say that men are more hierarchical than women. Men are more competitive and more hierarchical. But you know, all the primate groups that I know have female hierarchies. All of them have female competition. All of them have an alpha female. And so female leadership is really not hard to find in the primates. And I'm not convinced at all that males are more hierarchical than females. And when experiments have been done with humans, so there are certain psychological experiments where they throw five men in a room or five women in a room, and they let them decide something, and they measure who follows them, the hierarchy. The men make a rank order quicker, more quickly than the women, but the women always make one. And so we have certain prejudices about the differences between the genders that are simply not supported, I would say. Mm-hmm. So that's an important part of my book also, is to point some of these things out.
Right. And I imagine that in females, it also might be subtler. Like my own research focuses on human adolescent social development. And with bullying, for example, you see overt versus relational victimization, and boys are more likely to hit each other and bully in a way that's physically obvious. And then girls, it might be relational, like excluding others or things that aren't so obvious.
Yeah, that's very interesting. There was a scientist, Laga Spitz. Have you ever heard of her?
I haven't.
A Finnish psychologist who did studies of children in schoolyards. And she said, if you look at the schoolyard and you measure how many fights happen, you find many more fights among the boys than among the girls. If you ask the children at the end of the day, did you have a fight? You find as many girl fights as boy fights. What does that mean? That means that the girl fights are invisible. And she called it indirect aggression. And she said, what the girls do is they exclude each other, or they write notes about each other. Nowadays, of course, with the social media, that's a very common thing to do. And so the competition is there, but it's expressed very differently between boys and between girls. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think these gender differences are really interesting.
Yeah. A related thing you mentioned in your book when talking about psychology research and contrasting it to primatology or even to biology more generally is that it doesn't seem to have that same unbiased descriptive stance. Like in the bully literature, for example, there's kind of always this undertone of bullying is bad. Here's what we can do to stop it, rather than just taking this observational stance of here's what happens and how it happens.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a real problem, is that psychology is very normative in a way. It's like if you read a psychology textbook, I'm a biologist by training, and I've been a psychology professor for 30 years. And so then I look at these textbooks that I get in psychology, and I look, for example, for dominance, social dominance. It doesn't occur. It doesn't occur in the textbooks because they don't want to talk about it, as if humans are completely egalitarian. Power. They don't talk about power either. So these textbooks are full of opinions about we need to be less racist and less sexist and less hierarchical. So there are certain things that they don't like about the human species. And instead of trying to explain where do these things come from and which societies show it more and which ones show it less, which could give you a cue about, you know, how it arises. No, they're very busy ideologically to explain how we ought to behave, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like once you understand what is, you can use that as sort of a framework for what ought to be. They don't really have to be connected. So it's like, you know, in understanding gender differences better, which seems to be the goal of this book, what can we do about that? We can, and sort of disentangle what's natural, what's social, what needs to be fixed, what needs to be accepted.
Yeah, so in the gender debate, I think we're focusing at the moment in society on the wrong problem. So you have gender inequality, and I make it very clear in my book that I'm against the inequality. I think the inequality is a problem, and it's a big problem, is that in our society, it may be diminishing, the inequality, but it's certainly not disappeared. And in other societies in the world, you know, there's a huge inequality between the genders. But the gender inequality, it's the inequality that's the problem. But people have tried to make gender into the problem. That's why we have so many people who want to raise their children gender neutral, or who sort of try to diminish the genders, or say, we don't need the genders. So they have made gender into the problem, but I think the inequality is the problem. I think gender is not something we're going to get rid of. We will all, because it's connected with the sexes and it will always exist. We need to focus on the inequalities. And we're doing that to some degree, of course, in society. We're doing that to some degree, but not enough, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Right. And understanding the naturalness of some things, like going back to Donna, seems to be a way towards acceptance. Like if you just take that, that this is natural variability in personality, we can accept that. It hopefully will lead to a...
That's of course what happens with homosexuality to some degree, is that once we start to accept, and it took a while, once we started to accept that it's not a lifestyle choice, that being gay is just how some people are born, and that means that biology is involved to some degree in it, once we started to accept that, I think the situation improved. And I think with transgender people, we are on the same path. At the moment, there's quite a bit of resistance, and people say, well, they make up these things, or it's a fashion, or whatever they say now. But once we accept that some people are born that way, I think acceptance will probably follow. That's my hope, at least. Yeah.
Right. Perhaps we could close on a more personal note. You've been a professor for several decades. How have you noticed students' perspective change as you talk about these sex differences in our closely related species, and how do they teach us more about ourselves?
Yes, I think the young people, they're more accepting, much more accepting of these things than the older people. So the resistance to, for example, transgender people or homosexuals, that's something you find in my generation. Older white men are, I think, the most resistant bunch of all of them. The younger people are very open and very accepting in general. They're less homophobic, they're less racist. So I'm not pessimistic about the younger generation based on what I've seen. There's a great curiosity. Now, you have to be careful. You can easily step on some toes if you talk to young people about gender issues. Obviously, you can step on some toes. And I try to avoid doing that. And for me, for me, it's maybe easier because I usually talk about the primates. I talk more about the primates than about humans. And mm-hmm. so it's fairly easy to avoid that. But and I can see why they are sensitive about it, because they have friends who are struggling being trans, or they are friends who are struggling being gay. And so they defend their friends also, you know, and they don't want them to be insulted by anybody. And I can understand that. So I'm actually quite optimistic about the young generation. I think they're doing well.
I think that's a great optimistic place to close. Professor DeWall, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.